Today, Riding the Seesaw, the Property Imperative Weekly, is the 10th of August 2019. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest posts covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today we cover some of the highlights and lowlights of the past week, a week in which we saw trade tensions rise further, markets got the shivers, and locally banks reported weaker results while the RBA dropped their forecasts in the light of weaker local and international news. And now everyone is talking of zero interest rates, which should be of no surprise to those who regularly follow our work. Even central banks in Australia and New Zealand discussed this topic this week. I'll start with a brief international overview and then cover the Australian scene. And if you want to jump to the Australian section, the time is shown below and in the comments. I'm also going to put the times for the main items in the review. With the move towards lower and negative interest rates around the traps, in a last gasp attempt to sustain the debt bomb some more, Zero Hedge wrote this week, over the past couple of weeks, various figures like France's Finance Minister Bruno Le Maire and American Senator Elizabeth Warren have called for a reorganisation of the banking system, with Le Maire saying on July the 13th that the Bretton Woods has reached its limits, and Warren stating on July the 22nd that the country's economic foundation is fragile. A single shock could bring it all down. It's no secret that the Western nations sit atop the largest financial bubble in human history, with global derivatives estimated at somewhere between $550 trillion to $1.2 quadrillion. And we agree. And this fragility was on full view this week. Let's look at the US markets first. Stocks were lower after the close on Friday, as losses in the technology, oil and gas, and basic material sectors led shares lower. In fact, each day over the last week produced either big losses or big gains. On Wednesday, there was a huge loss at the open, followed by a robust recovery, and on Friday was like Wednesday, with the major averages falling sharply after President Donald Trump suggested US negotiators would not meet with Chinese trade negotiators next month, and that there was talk the US would ban sales of chips from US companies to Chinese telecom Huawei. But things recovered into the close before falling again, setting up negative expectations for next week. At the close in New York, the Dow Jones Industrial Average declined 0.34% to 26,287 and is down 0.75% over the past week. It was off as many as 281 points early in the day before recovering to a small gain, but losing about 100 points in the last 10 minutes. The S&P 500 index declined 0.66% to 2,918 and was down 0.46% over the past week, while the Nasdaq composite slid 1% to 7,959 and is down 0.56% over the week. In fact, given the extreme volatility in recent days, these are not bad results. For the week, the indices were lower, but only modestly, despite the volatility. And the indices ended the week roughly 3% below their all-time highs, which were reached back in mid-July. Remember those heady days? US producer prices increased moderately in July, lifted by a rebound in the cost of energy products, while underlying producer inflation retreated, which could allow the Federal Reserve to cut interest rates again next month. The index for final demand rose 0.2% last month, after nudging up 0.1% in June. In the 12 months through to July, the PPI increased 1.7% after advancing by the same margin in June. Last month's increase in the PPI was in line with economists' expectations. Excluding the volatile food, energy and trade services components, producer prices edged down 0.1% last month. That was the first decline since October 2015 and followed an unchanged reading in June. The so-called core PPI increased 1.7% to the 12 months through to July and that's the smallest gain since January 2017 after rising 2.1% in June. And the benign inflation report from the Labour Department on Friday could boost expectations for a half percentage point cut at the Fed's September 17th, 18th policy meeting. And President Donald Trump on Friday urged the US Central Bank to lower rates by a full percentage point, saying there was no inflation in our country. Financial markets have fully priced in the 25 basis point cut following a recent escalation in the bitter trade war between the United States and China, which led to an inversion of the US Treasury yield curve and raised the risks of a recession. Fears about the trade war's impact on the economic expansion, the longest on record, prompted the Fed to lower its short-term rate last week for the first time since 2008. And the 10-year bond was at 1.745%, down 5.3% across the week, while the three-month stood at 1.997, down 3.25%. So the yield curve inversion is getting more severe, underscoring the expectations of a recession ahead. The financials index was all but flat at 451.27, but Goldman Sachs fell in midday trade on Friday after reports that 17 current and former bankers, including its CEO of its international division, were criminally charged by Malaysia for their involvement in the One Malaysia Development Berhad scandal. Malaysia's Attorney General claims that the accused were directors at three subsidiaries when the bank arranged for bond offerings to the wealth fund and misled investors, diverting $2.7 billion. Goldman Sachs says the charges are misdirected and will be defended. Some $4.5 billion was stolen from Malaysia's sovereign wealth fund and diverted into properties and movie funds by senior officials, the US Justice Department alleges. And elsewhere, the bank is dipping its toes in subprime lending as it decides who gets the new credit card for Apple Pay, CNBC reported. Some of those customers have less than ideal credit scores, the report said. The credit cards were rolled out this week to selected Apple customers before a bigger launch later in the month. Goldman Sachs shares ended at $206.86, down 1.20 over the week. The volatility index was up 6.27% to 1797 and is still elevated from lows of around 12 over the last month. With all the geopolitical tension, especially around trade, it's possible the foreseeable future could continue to be noisy or worse. Gold futures were down 0.08% to 1,508. It ended the week up 3.5% and above $1,500 for the week for the first time since 2013. Silver, palladium and platinum were also higher on the week, while crude oil for delivery in September rose 3.2% to $54.22 a barrel. The euro-US dollar was up 0.2% to 1.1200, and the US dollar futures index was down 0.06% to 97.375. Europe was led lower by a sharp drop in Italy, as one of the country's ruling parties called for snap elections, sending the stock market down over 2%, and the yield on its benchmark 10-year up 20 basis points to about 1.75%. That might not sound high, but when compared to the negative yields across most of the continent, it seems to indicate elevated risk. Over in Britain, the pound fell to a two-year low as UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson said he plans to hold new elections after October the 31st, when the country is expected to leave the European Union. Meanwhile, the opposition looks to be mulling a no-confidence vote in the Prime Minister. Once again, the UK seems to be split between those who favour a hard Brexit and those looking to delay and negotiate. And the market seems to be stuck in the middle. The FTSE ended at 7,253, down 0.44% on Friday and 2.07% lower across the week. The German 10-year bond was at minus 0.567, up 2.24% on the day and 14.55% over the week. Deutsche Bank fell 2.18% to 6.778. While many of Deutsche Bank's problems are self-inflicted, as CNN Business noted, Deutsche Bank's struggles have also been amplified by something the 149-year-old lender never imagined, mostly because it had never happened before in modern history: negative interest rates. In 2014, the European Central Bank wanted to boost the sluggish economy, but interest rates were already at zero. The unconventional decision to take them into negative territory was, of course, aimed at encouraging growth and avoiding deflation, but it meant banks were charged a fee for parking their reserves with the central bank. The ECB's extreme policies may have injected, well, some life into Europe's sleepy economy, in turn giving Deutsche Bank and other lenders a boost. However, negative interest rates are also crushing the profitability of all banks, Deutsche Bank included. And this unorthodox policy, one that the ECB is on the verge of doubling down on, is making it awfully difficult to revive the champion of Germany's banking system. Negative rates didn't cause Deutsche Bank's troubles, but they absolutely magnified them. Monetary policy in Europe has been spectacularly unsuccessful, said David Kelly, who's the chief global strategist at JP Morgan Funds. These negative rates are counterproductive. They are slowing the European economy down. And Kelly noted that Europe's economy depends more on bank lending than America's because the European capital markets aren't as deep. The banking industry cannot flourish on negative rates, he said, and that is acting as a drag on the entire European economy. But the ECB has signaled a willingness to try to mitigate the fallout from negative interest rates. The central bank's staff are drawing up what they've called a tiered system for reserves that would exempt some deposits from the most punitive rates. The Bank of Japan has a system where most deposits up to a certain level avoid the lowest rates. And the Swiss National Bank, another central bank with negative rates, also has a tiered system to ease the pain on banks. Goldman Sachs said a tiered system would be a critical part of any further rate cuts by the ECB. Without it, an extremely challenging operating environment becomes worse, it said. And I think there are some important parallels there and what may be happening in Australia ahead. Though the China trade situation ebbed a bit later in the week, the issue doesn't appear to be going away anytime soon. Telecom giant Huawei, which has been at the forefront of the trade battles, as well as the battle for 5G dominance, just announced the launch of a new operating system, saying it would switch from Alphabet's Android operating system immediately if needed. Plus, the White House announced it would delay a decision to allow US companies to resume business with China-based Huawei. Meanwhile, in China, early gains by Chinese stocks were erased after data showed that the country's producer prices fell for the first time in 3 years in July, while a sell-off in high-profile tech firms dampened already fragile sentiment. The benchmark Shanghai Composite was down 0.71% to 2,774, and the US yuan was at 7.0624, up 0.26%, while during the week, Trump accused China of currency manipulation, while China said they were just letting the market find its level. The move will make China's exports cheaper into the US, thus negating some of the impacts of the trade tariffs. And finally, Bitcoin continued its wild ride, down 0.73% on Friday to 11,972, reflecting the wider market durations. Overall, as Goldman put it, a bear market ahead is becoming more and more likely. Hi, it's Liz Interruption, but if you're getting value from this post and have not done so, please consider subscribing to this channel or ring the bell for custom alerts. Plus, please consider supporting our efforts. You can make a one-off donation via PayPal, here's the link, or subscribe via Patreon for as little as $3 US a month or more to get access to exclusive additional content. Alternatively, you can also donate using Bitcoin. Here is the QR code. The links are in the comments below. I really appreciate your support, which enables us to continue to make more great content. Thanks very much. Now, back to the current show. And so to the local scene. On Friday, RBA Governor Lowe gave evidence to the House Economic Committee as they published their latest statement on monetary policy. Of course, they had left the cash rate unchanged on Tuesday. The RBA has revised down its forecast for real GDP growth, with 2019 from 2.34% to 2.5%, reflecting the fact that growth in the first half of 2019 is likely to be around 1%, making the previous forecast of 2.75% highly unlikely. But the RBA retained its forecast for 2020 of 2.75%, which is around trend growth. And for 2021, the RBA has upgraded its growth forecast to 3% from 2.75% in the year to June 2021 previously, and has extended that 3% for the whole of 2021. We think this is way too optimistic. For underlying inflation, the previous forecast was 1.75% in 2019, 2% in 2020, and 2% for the year to June 2021. Now the RBA expects that inflation will be 1.5% in 2019, 1.75% in 2020, and then 2% in 2021. Remember, there were outcomes of 0.3% and 0.4% for the opening two quarters of 2019. This means that the RBA will miss its 2-3% target for another year or more. But the trimmed mean inflation rate for 2020 is forecast at 1.9% and 2.1% in 2020. Not sure how they get to that. Back in May, the unemployment rate was forecast to hold at 5% to December 2020 before falling to 4.75% by June 2021. But now we are at 5.24% for June 2019. And the new forecasts have the unemployment rate at 5.25% in 2019 and again in 2020, then edging down to 5% in 2021. All this is way above the governor's estimate of full employment of 4.5%. And so do wages. The forecast in May included the wage price index to increase by 2.5% in 2019 and 2.5% in 2020. These forecasts have now been lowered to 2.3% in both years. This is despite the underlying assumptions of lower interest rates and a lower currency. They say most firms anticipate little change in wages growth over the next year and takes account of higher unemployment. This forecast slowdown in wages growth is one of the major factors behind the downward revision in the inflation forecasts. But the other change is more directly worrying. Household consumption growth forecasts have been reduced from 2% in 2019 and 2.6% in 2020 to 1.5% in 2019 and 2.4% in 2020. These downward revisions reflect the slower than expected consumption growth already registered this year and the associated lower growth rates for household incomes in 2019. And so the RBA is now forecasting less progress on the inflation and unemployment targets than had been expected even back in the May statement on monetary policy, which assumed two rate cuts by year's end. And of course, we must bear in mind that these new forecasts are based around market pricing, which now includes 225 basis point rate cuts having been delivered and pricing for two additional cuts, one by the end of 2019 and one by mid-2020. And also the May forecast assumed an exchange rate to the US dollar of 70 cents compared with 68 cents currently. While the RBA emphasizes downside risks in the forecast from international developments, it is surprising that the actual forecast included no adjustments to major trading partner growth. However, the terms of trade are forecast lower ahead. Remember, the current rate of growth is weakening, and the trade balance is flattered by ultra-high iron ore prices, which are now coming back. So frankly, the statement appears to be an attempt to post-rationalise their past poor decisioning. So the latest statement on monetary policy, to me, seems too optimistic, partly because of the accelerated risks internationally, and partly because their rose-tinted spectacles appear to have been turned up to 11. And to cap it all, the governor acknowledged that rates will need to go lower and unconventional responses are likely. This echoes the New Zealand Reserve Bank governor, who cut rates there by 50 basis points to 1% and also said lower and even negative rates were possible ahead. But I do agree with Lowe on one point. The government needs to do more, even if the surplus is sacrificed as a result. But I don't think they will for now. we continue to discuss the issues around negative interest rates and the link to the draft bill to curtail cash transactions in Australia. This issue has garnered significant attention, and in our post, How Low Will You Go?, we go through the main issues and discuss the linkages. Remember, submissions close on Monday if you want to have your say. And this is not a theoretical discussion, as Bloomberg reported this week that 20-year mortgages in Denmark hit zero interest rates for the first time in history, and there are 10-year mortgages there with a negative 0.5% rate. Crazy or what? Business and household sentiment continues to weaken, with our mortgage stress indicators higher again despite the recent rate cuts. See our post, the latest mortgage stress and rate cut data. And household financial confidence continues to weaken again as wages remain flat and the cost of living continue to rise. See hot news, the latest household financial confidence index is out. And the PSI business index was also weaker, especially retail, as households continue to hunker down. The bright spot was the trade balance, which hit $8 billion in June, thanks to high iron ore prices and volume and flat imports, reflecting weaker demand. But now the iron ore price is sliding as demand from China eases, so this may be a drag on the economy ahead. The data on home prices was less positive this week. Auction clearances were lower at 66.4% compared with 68.6% last week, and total auctions were 1,108 compared with 1,324 a year back. Sydney reported 72% with 244 cleared, and Melbourne 70.9% with 326 cleared. So volumes are down, as are listings. Nothing here to suggest strong positive movements. And this is confirmed by the CoreLogic daily indices. So the CoreLogic index to the 8th of August 2019 shows that last week in Sydney, prices fell 0.02%. Over the quarter, they've risen 0.11%. Annually, they've fallen 8.9%, and from peak, they're down 14.7%. In Melbourne, they fell last week 0.08%. They've risen 0.14% over the quarter. Annually, they've dropped 8.1%, and from peak, they're down 10.8%. In Brisbane, they fell 0.08% over the last week. They're down 0.7% over the quarter. They've fallen 0.5% annually, and from peak, they're also down 2.5%. In Adelaide, they're down 0.09% over the last week. They've fallen 0.71% over the last quarter. They've fallen 0.9% over the last year. And from peak, they're down 1.4%. In Perth, they fell 0.05% over the last week. They've fallen 2.22% over the last quarter. They've dropped 8.8% annually. And from peak, they're at 20.3%. And across the major five, they're down 0.05% over the last week. Over the quarter, down 0.3%, annually, down 7.5%, and from peak, down 10.7%. And then we can look at the annual movements over the last year. In Sydney, there have been some positive movements, but it appears to have ended quite recently. In Melbourne, it's somewhat the same, with decaying prices again. In Brisbane, they continue to slide, as they do in Adelaide, as they do in Perth, and the five cities are also down. So on an average basis, and I always say these are averages, prices are perhaps sliding again, which may suggest that any correction that we've seen recently was a short-term only, and it's possible that prices may now slide further. The data on lending told the same weak story, with new finance approvals for owner-occupied borrowers down 13.6% over the year and for investors down 17.6%. Falls continued in all states, with New South Wales, Victoria and Queensland leading the way down. And as Westpac showed in their analysis of the data, foreign buyers are 83% down from peak. First-time buyers are down 12.5%, investors are down 48%, and upgraders are down 21% from peak. Only here do we see any evidence of acceleration, and it's small. You can watch our show, Is Lending Up or Lending Down, where we look at the data in more detail. And CoreLogic showed that falls from peak in real terms are down 36.3% in Perth, 39.9% in Darwin, 17.9% in Sydney, 12.9% in Melbourne, down 7.1% in Adelaide, and down 1.7% in Hobart. And the duration of these falls are now running over a longer period, with Perth looking at declines over, wait for it, 51 quarters. No wonder there are financial and social issues there. And property listings continue to fall, as the latest from SQM Research shows. Their market report for July, which posted another 2.8% fall in listings over the month, showed a 0.7% increase in listings over the year. Listings fell across all markets over July, whereas over the year, sales listings rose everywhere except Sydney, down 10.5%, Perth down 2.6%, and Darwin down 4.8%. And asking prices are generally lower. And our data suggests that high-rise apartments continue to be battered by the continued news around poor construction and flammable cladding. As Propertyology put it this week, as for any Australian contemplating buying a property now or in future years, be absolutely crystal clear that your structural integrity risk and financial performance risks are exponentially higher should you choose to purchase any medium to high-density apartment that was built during the last 20 years. The common denominator among the poorest performing assets is newer buildings, primarily because roughly 40% of the purchase price for the first owner are taxes associated with new builds. And they went on to say, the governance within Australia's construction industry is as poor as what the Banking Royal Commission exposed for the financial services sector, with an entire generation of housing supply corrupted by greed, vested interests, and with little regard for quality control, safety, and consumer best interests. Wow. And in a series of upcoming shows with our property insider, Edwin Almeida, we're going to discuss the latest on Mascot Towers, Opal Tower, and the fallout from Rylan. More downward pressure on prices, in a word. And so to the markets. The ASX 100 closed at 5,446 on Friday, up 0.21%, but down 2.75% over the week. The ASX Financials Index ended at 6,250, up 0.6%, but down 2.76% over the week. Among the majors, ANZ closed at $27, up 1.22%, but down 2.84% over the week. CBA, who reported this week, was at 79.42, up 0.58% on Friday, but down 3% across the week. And there was an 8.1% drop in profit over 2019 at $8.6 billion as compared to $9.4 billion the previous year. Net interest margin looks under pressure ahead thanks to lower cash rates, and non-performing loans are on the rise. The mortgage business may offer some support ahead, perhaps. CEO Matt Comyn partially attributed the subdued result to higher remediation costs totaling $2.2 billion in financial year 19, up $1 billion from the year before, specifically in the result. They also called out $275 million of revenue that's been foregone deliberately by choice that they've made to make sure that they are delivering better outcomes for customers. NAB stood at 27.65, down 0.29% on the day and 3.02% for the week, and Westpac closed at 28.21, up 0.53% on Friday, but down 2.12% across the week, not helped by APRA serving infringement notices on the bank and two of its subsidiaries for failing to meet their legal obligations to report data to APRA. Among the regionals, Suncorp also reported and closed at 13.80 on Friday, up 3.99%. Their statutory net profit was $125 million, down 83.5%, which includes the $910 million after-tax non-cash sale loss on the sale of the Australian life insurance and participating wealth business. Cash profit was up, however, to $1.115 billion, up 1.5%, and the 39 cents per share special dividend also fueled investor interest, despite pressure on margins. And also reporting was AMP, whose first half of 2019 results was a $2.3 billion loss due to non-cash impairments to write down goodwill in Australian wealth management and legacy issues as well. The wealth giant has also announced a $650 million fully underwritten capital raising, which will enable it to set out its new 3-year transitional business plan. AMP closed at 1.93, up 11.56% on Friday, as some investors begin to think it could look cheap, but there is still so much to do. The Aussie was weaker this week in response to the currency wars, and we discussed this in our post, and now the currency threat. It closed at 67.86, down 0.21%, and is likely to fall further. It is down 7.07% lower over the past year. The Aussie gold cross was at 2,206.84, up 4.16% through the week, thanks to a higher gold price and the exchange rate movements. The Aussie Bitcoin cross was at 17,575, up 10.3% over the week. And so, in conclusion, we continue to see what I regard as the late cycle pangs. See our post, end cycle or late cycle. By this, I mean, like it or not, economic performance is cyclical, sometimes up and sometimes down. But the evidence is mounting that we are heading towards the end of the current cycle, despite the attempt to sustain it for longer by cutting rates or even going negative to protect the current banking system. The trouble is the attempts to protect the system are now killing the patient and putting undue pressure on households, as well as allowing policymakers off the hook. Like it or not, it looks like that we are headed from the seesaw to the spin cycle, not a comfortable ride. And before I go, a quick reminder that we will be running our next live stream event on Tuesday, the 20th of August at 8 p.m. Sydney time. You can ask me questions in real time via the chat or beforehand using the DFA blog. The link is below, along with the show link if you want to bookmark the session. I look forward to seeing you there. And just one other quick piece of news. I'm pleased to say that my wife, Jill, had an operation last week, which was successful, and she's now on the mend. And I'm rather hoping that she may be able to come home after nearly 5 weeks in hospital. So I'm looking forward to that over the next few days. And once again, I want to thank all of those who've sent their best wishes to her. We really have appreciated them. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.